Hello and welcome to Future Projection, a Baseball America podcast. This is episode 81 of the show. I'm Carlos Clazo, joined as always by Ben Badler. How you doing, Ben?
I'm all right. I'm not supposed to be here, though. I'm supposed to supposed to be in the Dominican Republic right now.
Yeah, you've had a fun week, huh?
Yeah, we didn't record last week. We were supposed to record last week, and then I got the flu, which wiped me out as bad as I've been in a while. So no episode last week, and postponed my travel plans till next week. So I guess the good news is I guess I do get to talk to you this week, and we do get to have an episode this week. I did miss you last week.
Yeah, missed you as well. Hope you start to feel a little bit better. You've had the flu this year. I've already had COVID this year, although I think given what you talked about with your illness, I would much prefer having COVID over the flu. I really don't think I've ever actually had the flu, so I don't want to experience it really. But again, hope you start feeling better. Hope the trip coming up is good for you. Maybe as productive and fun as my trip last weekend to Wake Forest in Winston-Salem, watching Wake take on Duke. Really loaded matchup just in terms of prospect talent, and a ton of scouts were at that game as well, as you might not be surprised to hear, given that you could have five or six first rounders in this class from those two teams. So that was fun. We got spring training rolling. I guess the major league season is right around the corner. Ben, I'm not sure if you've been able to watch too much baseball lately, but there's plenty happening, plenty to talk about. But where do you want to start first? You want to talk about some spring training performers? You want to stay on the draft side and talk about that, or what's interesting you today?
I want to talk about one of our cover boys, Jackson Holliday, on the newest BA cover. I think it's now the all time, like, I don't know how many like magazines we were selling for like single print issues in like 1993. I don't know if we have records of that, but at least since we went to our online store, it sounds like it's our best-selling single copy issue with Adley Rutschman, Gunnar Henderson, and Jackson Holliday on the cover. Three, obviously, the previous three number one overall prospects in baseball for the Orioles. So I don't know. I don't think a lot of print magazines these days are doing record numbers. So definitely appreciate all the love and support from all you guys supporting what we do and buying. I think the cover looks really good. But
I do too. I think the cover also has some like meme characteristics too, because all of them look somewhat similar on the cover. And I know that was being joked about a lot, that Baltimore is basically just cloning baseball players. Both having just a run of three straight number one overall prospects, and the fact that they're just like white guys that look pretty similar. But no, Jackson, he looks good in spring training. The homer he hit the other day was impressive. It sounds like the returns of his second base defense have been strong. I mean, if you're the Orioles, are you starting this guy in your big league roster day one, or do you think he needs a little more seasoning, a little more polish in the minor leagues?
I don't know, man. Like guys like him, or you go back to like Fernando Tatis Jr., these guys just who are just super special talents just seem to break all sorts of conventional timelines and expectations that we have for them. I mean, he looks very comfortable. He's hitting, you know, as of right now, 323, 344, 613 in big league camp. I mean, not like going crazy over spring training stats or anything. I guess if you want to pick apart something, he has one walk versus 12 strikeouts in 32 plate appearances. But if you ask me, like, if there's a part of his game that I have no concern about, it's his plate discipline, strike zone judgment, his ability to, you know, swing at good pitches and lay off pitches outside the strike zone. So not a concern. I don't know. He has 18 regular season games in AAA last year. He's still 20 years old. It's only his second full season coming up. Like Gunnar Henderson last year was a rookie. He was 22 years old. He had played 65 games in AAA. I could see the case either way. I mean, and I'd probably, frankly, just like defer to the Orioles' judgment at this point. Like, if they send him down, I don't think it's service time manipulation. Like, I think they're a legitimate reason to say, all right, let's just give him a little bit more time, a little bit more development opportunity in the minor leagues before putting him there on the big league club. But at the same time, I mean, he could be like, you know, like we talked about, a different player, obviously, than Tatis. But, you know, that type of special talent where it's like he just keeps as high as our expectations are for him, he seems to just exceed them every time.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I think I agree with you. Like, it wouldn't be shocking if he was in the minors. It wouldn't be shocking if he started in the majors. I think he is a special enough talent that I would expect him to hold his own and be a valuable player pretty much from day one. I could see a case being made that he's only had 50, 60 games so far between AAA and AA. Maybe you want him to get a few more reps at second. I think maybe that is even less concerning to me. I think in general, most shortstops are pretty capable of handling second base without a ton of time. Maybe you see that differently. But between him and Wyatt Langford, I think there are some interesting roster decisions. Matt actually wrote a piece about this a week ago about the Wyatt Langford situation specifically, and just looking into how the prospect promotion incentive program increases his odds to make the team out of opening day. Just looking back at some players who have advantaged their teams by being pulled up, some players that maybe in hindsight you wish you could have pulled up: Tanner Bibee, Adley Rutschman, Michael Harris with the Braves, although to varying degrees, like all three of those guys, like, didn't necessarily make a ton of sense to make opening day rosters. And obviously just depends on open spots, how competitive the team is, just how old and how advanced the player is. But I would imagine that Wyatt Langford is even more so suited to just starting on the opening day roster. I mean, he's more physically advanced. He's 22 years old. He absolutely demolished AA and AAA. He has more experience against higher level competition, just being a college product coming out of the SEC. He's looked great in spring training as well. So that one will be interesting too. Have you seen much of Wyatt Langford recently?
Yeah, I would be starting him right in the big leagues. Would you?
I would, yeah. I would have even maybe wanted him up in the postseason as well.
Yeah.
Than just having a weapon off the bench, like having his power as a right-handed hitter off the bench seems like a pretty good asset. But the Rangers clearly did fine without him. But yeah, I would have wanted him there.
Well, especially when Adolis Garcia went down. I mean, it made a lot of sense to – it probably would have shocked a lot of people, I'm sure, but not if you're really closely following Wyatt Langford. I don't think it would be crazy to send him to AAA, but I would have him up – right now, take advantage of the PPI, although the biggest competition for him for that award is probably going to be his teammate, Evan Carter.
Yeah, I mean, it may be as simple as like having more bites at the apple to get that, like just increase your odds.
Yeah.
I mean, he's crushing spring training. You just mentioned spring training stats don't really matter, but he's hitting 379, 472, 828, four homers, a double, 10 strikeouts, five walks. He's been tremendous, as has Evan Carter. Also, well,
he's just crushed everywhere he's gone ever since they drafted him. And it's 70 power. It's a good swing. He controls the strike zone. It's contact with damage. There just are not a lot of holes there offensively in his game, whether it's, you know, your pitcher trying to game plan him. There's just not a lot of obvious holes that I see in terms of the swing or his tendency to chase or swing through certain types of pitches. He just seems like such a well-rounded hitter, and he's a well-rounded hitter who, again, has 70 raw power and is getting to that power in games. It's not even just, do you start him? It's not even just start him on opening day. I hit him in the middle of the lineup right away. I mean, he's that good of a hitter.
How much do you view a gap between Wyatt Langford and Dylan Cruz at this point, just based on what he's done in pro ball, if you do see like a significant gap between those players at this stage?
I don't think it's a huge gap between them, but I think Cruz has a defensive advantage over Langford. I don't think Langford has the defensive ability or defensive value that Cruz has, and I think offensively it's pretty close. And I probably would have said Cruz ahead coming into the draft, but what Langford has shown in Pro Bowl, you know, it's not a huge, you know, it's not like we've seen, 300 plate appearances from each of them in Pro Bowl, but we still seen a good amount of each of them swinging wood bats, facing pro competition. I know, look, I know they're seeing some good arms in the SEC, but it's not the same as when these guys are going out in Pro Bowl, going up, high A, double A, pitching, or triple A too, I think in Langford's case. So what he's done since getting drafted, I think, is only cemented or added to his value.
Yeah,
do I mean, you see it similarly, or you see it different?
No, that makes sense. I think I just remember during the spring prior to the draft, I was making a point to talk about Wyatt Langford in the same tier of player as Dylan Cruz, because I think at that point, Dylan Cruz had a lot more notoriety, a lot more fame, just being a part of that LSU team, having his high school pedigree that he did. I think he was the more famous prospect. And I just remember hearing from some scouts early on that, like, there are people who prefer Wyatt Langford to Dylan Cruz, and they think they're basically a similar level of talent. It's just like, do you prefer the guy that has the power? It may be less defensive value in the outfield, or do you prefer the guy like Dylan Cruz, who maybe has slightly less power, maybe a slightly better hit tool, and then more advanced supplemental tools and better defensive profile? So I viewed them pretty neck and neck at the time. We had Dylan Cruz ahead of Wyatt Langford, but I think the Langford, Cruz, Skeens tier of players, like, you could put them in literally any order that you want to come up with, and I think it would be defensible. And then I think after the draft, like, Wyatt Langford going off wasn't shocking to me because of just seeing him in college, seeing the power that he showed, knowing how good of a hitter he really was. Nothing about his profile really changed to me. And so, like, the numbers, they didn't change how I viewed him as a player. They just, like, maybe added some confidence in his hitting ability because he's doing it. But I would say, like, my opinion on both these two hasn't really changed too much. I think even today, I would probably still take Dylan Cruz because I think he's going to be a very similar hitter to Wyatt Langford overall. I just have such high confidence in his pure hitting ability. I think he is incredibly strong. His average exit velocities have been impressive in college and in pro ball. And I think the difference in where he's going to be able to play and add value defensively, I think might wind up still making him a more valuable player. It wouldn't shock me if Langford just hit for so much power that he is the player you would take. But at least now, without their pro career or their big league careers having started, I would probably have a slight edge toward Dylan Cruz. But again, it's razor thin. I don't blame anyone for taking one or the other, but I wouldn't view it as a noticeable or a notable gap between them by any means at this stage.
But you would have Langford if you were running the Rangers on their opening day roster.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But if you were the Nationals, would you have Dylan Cruz up right now?
See, with them, like, the competitive, where these teams are at competitively, like, there's a chance that Langford makes a notable difference in where they finish in the division, how successful they are this year. I don't think Dylan Cruz, if he's on the team over the full season, changes the success level that the Nationals are going to have regarding the playoffs. I would want to put the best big league team out there regardless. So guys like James Wood and Dylan Cruz will be up very quickly. I mean, it's not like the Nationals outfield has a lot of players that should be blocking these two players. I think the Nationals would benefit from a PPI pick if Dylan Cruz did come up and play the whole season and was productive. Like, these guys are already 21, 22 years old. I don't see the harm in starting their career right now, but I also would understand, just given how teams have operated, the benefit of holding Dylan Cruz back to get that extra year of control. I'm glad now there is like a lever that MLB has put on teams to try and make that decision more difficult. They really had to fight against that. I don't know. Like, there's no reason to me, skill wise, physicality wise, that Cruz couldn't be ready in the big leagues right now. I mean, he's not lighting spring training on fire, but do we really think that the Nationals outfield is better with some veteran that has more experience than Dylan Cruz? I don't really think so. I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I don't think they have much of any chance to go to the postseason this year, so I don't think there's any chance that you see Dylan Cruz in their opening day lineup. But you're saying, so if the Rangers, let's say, had drafted Dylan, let's say the Nationals had drafted Wyatt Langford and Dylan Cruz somehow got to the Rangers, you think you'd have Dylan Cruz on the opening day roster for the Rangers?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Okay.
Again, and it's interesting too, because like, I would want Dylan Cruz playing center field every day. I mean, the Nationals have Victor Robles. I imagine he's probably, like, in a vacuum, a better defensive center fielder. But if you don't think Victor Robles is going to be, like, an everyday player when you're a competitive team, like, do you think it is more valuable to this season get the best possible outfield defense? Or would you rather get your top pick, who you've invested this significant amount of draft capital and money to this stage, getting reps in center field? Like, I think Dylan Cruz can be an everyday center fielder, and I think his profile is significantly better if he's playing that every day. Like, would you rather have an outfield of Robles and Dylan Cruz and James Wood in the corners? I don't know. I don't really view Robles as like an impact player at this stage. So I think I would prioritize Dylan Cruz being up in the big leagues, playing center field, kind of growing with guys like CJ Abrams, Mackenzie Gore in the rotation, like this next wave. I just want to get them there and see if you can maybe accelerate the rebuild. If Cruz and Wood come up and they're impactful players right away, I imagine that changes your timeline.
So in the AL, I think there's a lot of motivation, or a lot more motivation, is it fair to say, for the PPI picks this year than there is in the National League, where you have to compete against Yoshinobu Yamamoto for a potential NL Rookie of the Year.
I guess that's fair, but at that stage, you're really like metagaming and maybe out-strategizing. Like, who's to say Yoshi doesn't get hurt in the first month of the season? Like, he's a pitcher. Any of these guys can get hurt at any point. Like, maybe he's just solid and doesn't win Rookie of the Year. Like, sure, certainly he's the favorite. Maybe that would matter less to you. But you also... you still have the PPI for the next 3 years,
right?
If he like is an MVP candidate. I mean, I certainly think that Dylan Cruz has the talent to become that sort of player. Like, a guy like Bobby Witt Jr. Is entering that stage. It wouldn't shock me if Cruz was that caliber of player as well. So I wouldn't want to outthink myself just on that specifically, but maybe that is just another little point towards saying, you know, it might be worth just getting an extra year of service time with a guy like Cruz. It certainly is a less automatic decision with the Nationals and Cruz. And I'm assuming that Dylan Cruz is not going to start on the opening day roster, both because it just seems like an easier call for them. And he also has not been lighting the world on fire in spring training. He's not really forcing their hand with what he's done
Did he in Double A last year, either when he got there.
Sure. Yeah, he wasn't like lighting the world on fire. But I think in terms of his batted ball data, in terms of what he did in the minor leagues as a whole, I think people really kind of hammer Dylan Cruz because his, like, how many games of Double A? I'm pulling up his numbers right now.
20 games.
Yeah, 20 games in Double A. He was great in low A, Fredericksburg. Like, overall, his numbers in the minors are good. If you take the entire 35-game sample, I don't think there was really anything too concerning to me in what he did in Double A, in terms of like the swing decisions, the power or lack thereof. Like, 20 games of a Double A sample is not going to be too much of an issue for me for a guy who just came out of college. Like, it's almost like, I feel like we talked about this a few weeks ago. If a player does really well, it's encouraging to you, but I'm not going to get too bent out of shape if the performance in a really small sample is not great. I just think the tools, the approach, the swing, I think everything is good enough that I wouldn't be concerned until it's a more lengthy sample of time where he's not performing before I would have any issues.
Well, just to be clear, if a player's, you know, in spring training, if he's struggling, it's not an issue if I like the player. If I don't really like the player and he's struggling, then that it actually is meaningful. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's more evidence that I'm right. Mm. No, I don't really have long-term concerns with Cruz, but to me, I would start him in the minor leagues. Like, yeah. There's very few players, obviously, whether it's pitching or pitchers or hitters who go straight from college draft pick the previous July to being on an opening day roster.
If Nolan Shanwell is getting pushed as fast as he got pushed with LA and hitting for as little impact, I think Dylan Cruz would be just fine in the big leagues.
All right.
For an equally uncompetitive team, I might add. Maybe the degree to their competitiveness is a slightly different, but the point stands. Yeah. Not playoff teams pushing players.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's not often you get a top five overall pick playing on a team that just won the World Series. So,
yeah. Well, I don't know that Paul Skeens is a guy that we had planned on talking about today, but because I consider him in that like trio of elite talents from the 2023 class, and I would also imagine it's hard to sketch out a Pittsburgh starting rotation if you're trying to find the most talented rotation you can in that organization. It would be very difficult for me to see a group of five names that doesn't include Paul Skeens and honestly maybe Jared Jones at this point. So what do you think about whether or not you would put Skeens in the big leagues from day one, or whether or not you think he needs more time in the minors?
I think you could. If you do, you're gonna have to shut him down at some point prematurely, or not.
Yeah,
like I don't think he's ready to handle a full season, or at least I don't think the Pirates would have him throw full season starters, major league starters workload.
Okay, here's my question: why do you not think that he's ready for that? Because I think in some ways Paul Skeens is maybe the ideal pitcher that would be more suited for transitioning to a pro workload and handling those innings, because he already handled a really large workload with LSU last year. I mean, he threw 122 innings in college. Yes, he's throwing less frequently in terms of between starts, but 122 innings is really not all that far off from like your average starting pitcher at the big leagues. If you wanted to give him breaks in between starts, like just to kind of get him more settled into a pro schedule, that would make sense. But I don't see any reason why, if Paul Skeens is healthy, he can't throw 150 innings this year. And if he's doing it at the big leagues, great.
Yeah, yeah, that could be. I get, but I think throwing once a week is different.
Definitely.
Than throwing on a major league starter's schedule, where you're going to have fewer days rest in between starts. Now you're going to increase his innings, hopefully by at least 30-plus innings next year. I mean, you could hold him back, like you said, skip starts, things like that. But
I mean, again, like from 2022 to 2023, he went from 85 innings to 122 innings. So that was a pretty significant step forward. I think the two-way element here is worth mentioning. He was a two-way player at Air Force, so you could probably make the case that he had less stress and wear and tear on the body while throwing those more innings, just because he was never hitting and not having to recover from like each and every game, and he's just focusing on rehabbing in between starts. But I think that's a pretty good stepping stone towards getting acclimated to a pro schedule. And I also just think that Paul Skeens is such a physical monster and such an impressive athlete. Like, this would be the player that I would be more open to getting aggressive with compared to like a high school player who's less physically developed, or a pitcher who's just not as much of an athlete. And I would be maybe concerned about some of the small adjustments that need to be made in between outings, things like that. On top of like just the makeup you hear about him coming from that military background, how he prepares off the field, how he takes care of his body, how he recovers. Like, I just think like if there's one player in terms of talent, physicality, and experience that I would feel comfortable pushing, it is this kind of guy.
Yeah, I'm not saying he can't do it or that he shouldn't be breaking camp with a team, but I think my point is more historically, this is not what teams, Pirates or otherwise, have typically done with their players, and teams generally look to what have we done or what have other players done in the past, and they're a little bit more regimented, paint by the numbers with this stuff. So
do you remember how Steven Strasburg was handled? Because he was quicker, but I don't remember exactly what the usage was with him.
He definitely went to the minor leagues. I remember that. He was not in the minor leagues very long, but I remember.
So drafted 2009. He threw 19 innings in the Arizona Fall League after being drafted in 2010. It looks like he had 11 starts between AA and AAA, and then he was promoted to the majors. So he threw 55 innings in the minors in 2010, and then he came up and threw 68 innings over 12 starts with the big league team. So is it a case of, like, do you think that is a usage pattern that, that Skeens should be able to follow? Would you include him in that sort of talent, or do you think Strasburg is still just like the outlier of outliers, and you'd want to follow a more maybe typical assignment pattern for
in terms of the 120 pitcher or so innings that
not necessarily the innings, but just like getting him in the upper minors, and then if he does well, maybe then putting him up in the bigs?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I mean, if the Pirates were in a situation where they were competing for a playoff spot this year, I think there'd probably be more urgency to have him maybe on the opening day roster, but
yeah,
I don't know, probably pretty similar playoff chances to the Nationals this year.
Yeah.
So like, I don't think they're going to rush him there. And like with him, there are things like, I don't think he's a, not that anybody's necessarily a finished product. There's always skills that are, you know, even if you're, you know, you're 29 years old, there's skills that are atrophying and new ways you need to constantly adjust and adapt. But, you know, they're like, he could use his changeup more. Like, there's a changeup in there, but is he gonna, you know, use it at the major league level right away? Like, as he's just, you know, you know, when the wins and losses matter, maybe not. I don't think they're manipulating his service time, let's say, but
I agree. Yeah.
By sending him to the minor leagues,
I wouldn't levy that sort of criticism, but I definitely feel myself as we're talking about this being on like the ultra aggressive side of wanting to promote these guys.
I would be a fan of that, but I understand why they're sending him down too. Whereas you think Jarrett Jones.
Yeah. Stays, I was about to ask about him.
Well, I don't quite. So, I mean, he's been obviously generating a lot of buzz in spring training this year. He's touching 100 miles an hour. He was sitting 96, 99 miles an hour the other day. It's been four games, 7 1/3, no runs, 3 hits, 3 walks, 6 strikeouts. To me, I don't know. Like, we have Jarrett Jones as the number 74 prospect on the top 100.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand the excitement. He's a good prospect. And, you know, there's Paul Skeens, we just talked about. He's coming, but not going to be in Pittsburgh for the start of the season, whereas it looks like Jarrett Jones does have a good chance to do that now. I just don't see anything that would alter our forecast for Jarrett Jones. I mean, he was touching 100 miles an hour last year, too. I don't know.
It feels like he was touching 100 back in high school. I know he actually wasn't that high, but he was a pretty electric-armed kid even when he was a two-way player back in California.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a measurable difference in the stuff this year compared to last year. He was in AAA for most of last season, 4.72 ERA in 82 innings, 28% K rate, 10% walk rate there. I think he's probably earned a spot in their rotation right now. But I don't think this is like, oh, wow, like we need to move Jarrett Jones up our list because of something new that we're seeing this spring. It just seems like the stuff is a continuation of what we were seeing last year, too.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I was pretty high on him this offseason after just reading the reports about some of the improvements he'd made and just seeing the overall performance at the upper levels of the minors, the strike throwing just being better than what I would have expected it to be after he was drafted. Obviously, it's been quite a while since he was drafted in 2020, but it just seems like he took a good step forward overall as a pitcher in 2023. I don't know if the stuff was ever really much of a question, and I do think like it probably is a little easy to get overly excited about just some velocity numbers that you're seeing in spring training, both because like everyone has access to it and you can just kind of shout about it and say, hey, look at this velo and this abbreviated start here, it's higher than his average. Most pitchers, I'd say, even I've been looking at this for a lot for the draft pitchers, like most pitchers are going to be above their season average from the previous year at the beginning of a new year. They're out, they're throwing shorter stints, they're fresh, they're throwing hard. Like as they get stretched out and the season progresses, that tends to, or at least on the draft side, it has tended to tick down. So yeah, I'm not super like changing how I view him as a prospect, but I do think it's interesting to think about him making this opening day roster for the Pirates. Again, just looking at the other arms they have in their rotation, he would be a guy that I'm really excited to see in this mix, and I think that he's like close to earned a spot and a shot if he hasn't already. Like, I guess what more would you want to see from him in the upper minors, or what was your ETA for him in the big leagues entering this year? Like, is he a guy that you kind of looked at and said, you know, good step forward in 2023, maybe another year at AAA, and if he's succeeding coming up in 24, what was your kind of expectation for when he would be debuting?
No, I mean, we've already seen, what, half a season, more than half a season from him in AAA. I think at this point, I would throw him into the big leagues and see what he can do.
Yeah, I agree. Yep, we're starting to see this next wave of Pirates pitching prospects kind of get up to this point. So, I mean, maybe Jared Jones is just one of the first of this. Obviously, we've seen some pitchers kind of already reach that, but, I mean, they've got a ton on the way. And I think, I mean, I'm only optimistic about Jared Jones. He's such a great athlete, and he was fun to watch pitch. So seeing him in the bigs will be is fun as well.
Yeah. You know who... The Padres have a couple guys this year, couple rookies or potential rookies, probably likely will be up, maybe both on opening day. But I mean, Jackson Merrill seems like the one of the talks of camp out there this spring. He's hitting 344, 400, 531 in 35 plate appearances. Only two strikeouts this year. I mean, he, another guy where he just seems like such a super, super talented hitter. I think some of the like injuries, or I guess in his case, really illness, kind of masked his talent level last year. Like he was just coming back from that stomach bug and he had a hamstring injury later in the season. But like when he's fully healthy, which it looks like he is now, you can see how good this guy is. I mean, first round pick a few years ago at a high school. We're talking about him potentially making the opening day roster. I mean, he's a shortstop, or was a shortstop at this point. And I guess everybody on the Padres was a shortstop, but it seems like his bat is just so good. They're trying to force his bat into the lineup any way they can get him in there. And based on the way he's looked this spring and really last year too, when he was healthy, I don't blame him.
Yeah. JJ's piece recently about the Padres potentially having basically an entire lineup outside of pitcher and catcher of former shortstops, I thought was a really interesting one. I didn't realize that prior to him writing about it. And I thought it also illustrated just, how beneficial it is how much of a non-issue it is when you're taking shortstops when you already have shortstops. Because I mean, Jackson Merrill is simply a great athlete and a good baseball player. The way he's taken to the outfield has been impressive to see. Shortstops in general are the best athletes on the field, and so it's not surprising that he's able to move to another position and look quite good there. So I think that just kind of hammers home what we talk about on this podcast a lot, that you don't really need to draft. If you already have a good shortstop, you're not losing anything by drafting another one. And oftentimes these are players who are going to move down the defensive spectrum throughout their career. And you hope they do, because if they do, then they're sticking around because they're good hitters and you still want to put their bat in the lineup. And I think with Merrill specifically, I maybe am kind of sleeping on how much power he really does have. It sounds like there's significant juice in the tank. He's quite a bit stronger now and bigger and more physical, which is unsurprising since like I saw him in person in high school. He was an interesting draft player at the time. Late in the spring, he was getting a lot of buzz, and it was kind of like everyone thought he was a day one guy on draft day after really not being, I guess, hugely on the radar prior to that spring. He was kind of polarizing because he didn't have a ton of history leading up to the draft. And so teams like the Padres, seems like the Rangers, seems like the Rays, just seem like they're more willing to take a shot on guys like that If they trust their scouts and they see a guy that's popping up, they're like, hey, we like the athlete, we like the tools, we're going to take him. And this one has looked like a good pick for them so far. What are your thoughts on the power potential? Where do you think his best position is moving forward? And I guess if you have any other thoughts on just like a bunch of shortstops running around playing non-shortstop positions.
Yeah, I mean, we saw 15 home runs from him last year as a 20-year-old. It's hard contact. There's not much swing and miss in the strike zone either. It's a lot of barrel frequency. I think, yeah, like you said, there's bat speed. He's gotten stronger, and he's just kind of entering his physical prime right now. So I think he's somebody where, yeah, I think we will see certainly 20-plus home run seasons from him. Potentially 25 plus home runs for him, which, you know, to go with the hit tool that he has as well, I think he's going to be a guy who gets on base at a pretty high clip too. So, cause there's, you know, not a ton of swing and miss. He hangs in well against, you know, righties and lefties. Like I don't see a big platoon split with him. He seems just like a really good hitter, no matter what type of pitcher he's facing. So yeah, I think it's potential 25 plus home run power. I mean, we're seeing exit velocities up to I don't have this spring in front of me right now, but you know, certainly last year it was up to 112 miles an hour. I think there's probably potential for a little bit more in the tank too. And I think, yeah, we could see him as a potential middle of the order type hitter, maybe not right away, but certainly within the next few years, I think he has a chance to be that kind of guy.
Yeah, this Padres lineup can be pretty good if Merrill comes up and he hits to expectations. They just have a lot of athletes, dynamic sort of hitters in the lineup. So I guess maybe the outfield defense will be interesting to see, because there's not a lot of players with like a ton of experience in the outfield. I would even include like Fernando Tatis there. Like, I don't know what you think of him as an outfield defender, but certainly the Padres are always a fun team to watch, and they're shaping up to be another fun team to watch in 2024. And we haven't even talked about Graham Pauly, who is maybe less prospect pedigree, but has also been hitting really well in spring training. I just had his numbers a second ago. He's hitting 323, 417, 516. He's got a home run, a triple, a double. Do you like Graham Pauly, Ben? I mean, entering the year, we had him as the number 10 prospect in a shockingly really good Padres system. Doesn't seem like he has really loud or sexy tools anywhere, but just does a lot well, and everyone speaks really highly of just his aptitude, baseball IQ, like work ethic. He's a guy who's consistently kind of been better than expected.
Yeah, I think he's underrated. I mean, there's some good players ahead of him in that Padres organization, obviously. Mm-hmm. Six in the top 100, and some pretty good young outfielders ahead of him with Samuel Zavala and Dylan Head. I like both those guys, but feel like Pauly kind of gets lost in the shuffle. Mm-hmm. Here he's a 13th round pick out of Duke a couple of years ago in 2022, plays his first full season last year, and he hit everywhere he went, all the way up to double A. There's natural feel for the barrel, he recognized pitches, he has good back control, there's very little swing and miss in the strike zone, and he gets on base at a high rate. So the power is maybe average. I don't think he's not going to have Jackson Merrill's power, I don't think. But I do think it's going to play up because of the barrel frequency more so than the raw power itself. And he's certainly an offensive-minded prospect who has moved around last year, mostly third base, some second base. Probably not going to be a spot for him going forward unless barring an injury, but left field too. It's hard to say a guy with his background who's only played 20 games in Double A is going to make their opening day roster, but I don't know. He could, and if not, I would send him to Triple A and expect him, with the expectation that he'll be up, you know, by the second half at the latest.
Yeah, I know. The defensive versatility, I feel like with this entire team, leaves a lot of flexibility for the lineup based on just performance, injuries. Like, you can move a lot of players around to really create a lineup with all sorts of moving parts. And the fact that he has played a few different positions. Like maybe he's not the super utility type of player who's going to go to any position and just be really good there. But the fact that he has played a number of different positions, a couple of places on the infield, has played left field, assuming he could play right field as well, even if maybe you've got some better arms on the big league roster. I think that only helps his cause. And like you said, it would be kind of shocking considering he started 2023 as a 22-year-old in low A, making the opening day roster. But if there's any team that is not afraid to be aggressive with their promotions of players, it does seem to be the Padres and AJ Preller. So it wouldn't be shocking to me. And Pauly's just been a fun prospect to watch, like, ascend over this last year or so.
Yeah, I think the Padres have a chance to be a sneaky sleeper team this year. I mean, there was so much hype on them this time last year because of how much they had spent and all the big names they brought in. And I thought they just had, I mean, they were awful last year in one run games. They were terrible in extra inning games. It's not the same team, obviously. You know, no more Juan Soto, there's no more Blake Snell, but I think this lineup is still pretty good. I think there's probably more depth overall on the roster that they didn't have last year. So the expectations certainly are going to be a lot lower this year, but I think this team has a chance to be a sneaky playoff contender still.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we talked about it over the offseason when we talked about just the NL West overall, how unlucky the Padres had been. The pitching is definitely going to be a question mark. Like, how are they going to replace some of those innings they're losing? Are those guys going to stay healthy? What's the quality of those innings going to look like? But if you're bringing back just mostly the same team, which, again, I think on the hitting side, you pretty much are.
Well, I expect Juan Soto.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe. Yep. True. They are less talented this year, but I think it would be really surprising if they were as unlucky as they were a year ago, I guess. And so I probably will lean towards being more bullish on them than maybe the expectations, because of just that. And also guys like Merrill, guys like Pauly, even some players in their organization beyond that I am really excited about moving forward. Like, a lot of the guys that I'm most excited about in the system are further down, further away. But Drew Thorpe is here now. Like, what's his role going to be moving forward? I'm not sure. I don't know how many reinforcements they have internally on the pitching side. It does seem like the Padres have been better at promoting hitters than getting, like, reinforcements on the pitching side from their organization. Maybe that'll change this year. But, yeah, I would be slightly optimistic about them just based on, like, what I perceive to be the expectations right now. Like, would you be more bullish on them or the Giants?
Oh, I would be more. I'm more optimistic about the Padres.
How would you view them compared to the D-backs?
Ooh, yeah. See, I think the D-backs have a lot of regression risk, but I mean, they still were. I mean, they were a good young team. Like, not that Corbin Carroll could be much better than he was last year, but I mean, I think he could be an MVP type player.
Yeah.
This year, I think Gabriel Moreno could take a step forward. Like, if Jordan Lawler can step in and be an impact player right away, that would be huge for them. So, yeah, I mean, I would still say that the D-backs have to be the favorites ahead of them. I just think if you're going to ask, like, all right, who's a team that people are expecting to miss or maybe even have very little chance of making the playoffs this year that is underrated, that would be my pick, the Padres.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, do you think that this division will be competitive at all, or is it basically just the Dodgers and then whoever's next? Like, do you think there's any team talented enough to push them?
The Dodgers? No, I don't think anybody's even close to the Dodgers this year. Do you?
I don't think so, but I want it to be close. Yeah. I don't want them to run away with the division. I mean, it's hard to look at that team on paper and not expect them to just kind of blow everyone out of the water. So,
yeah, I don't think they get any worse with Ohtani and Yamamoto and Tyler Glasnow. It's hard to bet against them.
Yeah, Mookie Betts at shortstop will be fun.
Mookie Betts now at shortstop. Traded. Trade Michael Bush, who, like, wasn't even a part of their team last year, also to help their team. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous how much talent they have right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So NL West will be fun. All right, any other spring training names who have jumped out to you want to touch on?
Thomas Segese is just like another guy who, you know, with the Cardinals, former Texas Ranger, who just always seems to hit everywhere he goes. Spring training seems like it's no different. It's 400, 444, 600 in 27 plate appearances. He's only struck out twice. This is a career 298, 369, 508 hitter in the minor leagues through mostly through Double A, but a little bit of Triple A time last year too. 22 years old, or will turn 22 in a month. So, he just everywhere he goes, he hits. Like, I think there's some question about like how much of that power, like some of the power numbers. He had 26 home runs. Like, you look at the exit velocity numbers, doesn't quite seem to match with the power numbers that he's shown. So does that come back to earth, or is he one of these guys where the barrel frequency and the angles that he hits the ball allows that power to play up in games? I'm in on his bat. I mean, I think it's legit.
Yeah, I mean, this is another player from that 2020 Texas Rangers draft that really, like, three of the five players involved in that draft class for them have played key roles in the Rangers winning a World Series. Evan Carter, obviously, on the field, but Thomas Segese, a fifth-round pick. Again, this was a draft where I think the Rangers had a few kind of surprising picks. We had Thomas Segese ranked, unlike Evan Carter at the time, but he wasn't, like, a super highly ranked guy. We ranked him 279 in the class. He did have a pretty solid track record at the time of making a lot of contact, hitting the ball hard, performing in games. But him and Tekoa Roby being in the trade that sent the Rangers Jordan Montgomery was pretty important for that season. So just outside of Segese as a player now, I am just constantly looking back at this 2020 Rangers draft and kind of marveling at it. I remember just asking people at the time, because Evan Carter was such a surprising pick. Like, there were a lot of people that were like, what are the Rangers doing here with some of these players? But they were clearly on it. They had them scouted up. They knew what they were doing. And yeah, Segese looks like another really impressive hitter. I don't have much to add on him specifically outside of that, but nice job to the Rangers scouting department.
Yeah, he's looked good. You know who else is, well, an interesting guy to me, at least with the Brewers, is Wes Clark, who was at South Carolina. You know, they drafted him out of South Carolina, I think, like a 10th round pick in 2021. He was a catcher, but like, he still has caught some, but at this point it's mostly first base. I think long term it's going to be, you know, first base / DH or maybe emergency catcher. But so he's hitting 286, 318, 857 this year in 22 plate appearances, four home runs already, but no walks, 10 strikeouts, which is kind of the Wes Clark experience. Although usually he does, that's not totally fair. He does walk a good amount, but he's 6 feet, not all that tall, but he's huge. He's strong, 70 raw power, exit velocities up to 115 last year. The swing itself, right-handed hitter, doesn't have a lot of wasted movement with his swing. There's not a lot of moving parts going on, but the path itself is pretty steep, and he has not done a great job of recognizing breaking balls. So there are holes that pitchers can exploit, but last year, finished the year in Double A, or I should say, spent the year in Double A, hit 26 home runs, 241, 392, 498 as a 23-year-old. There's the profile is a little scary. It's a little, you know, reminiscent of hitters like Like a Vladimir Ballantyn, right? Who can guys who can go over and be big right-handed hitting mashers in Japan, but who have that 4A hitter type risk. But I also think, especially for a 10th round pick, this is a legitimate prospect who, maybe just because of the talent in the Brewers farm system, where they are the number two farm system in baseball, I think he gets a little bit overlooked because there's huge power there and he does draw walks, but there is definitely some of that 4A risk there, but he's definitely made himself into a pretty legitimate prospect at this point.
Yeah, I think just based on knowing Wes Clark out of the draft, he's already exceeded my expectations for him. A lot of what you just talked about for him as a hitter were question marks that he had coming out of South Carolina when he was drafted in the 10th round in 2021. He was never a good hitter against breaking stuff in offseat offerings. And hearing you talk about the fact that he still has issues picking up spin just tells me that he's not really made a tangible improvement there. I think that probably is just always going to be the sort of hitter he is. I'm curious if you have thoughts on his bat speed, because I know at the time as an amateur, there were a lot of scouts who thought he was just a big, strong guy who could kind of muscle balls out of the park at that stage. I mean, he was posting a strikeout rate around 30% in college. That swing and miss and just the inability to make adjustments versus off-speed stuff has always been the big question. If that's still a question, I'm curious if he's just elite at timing fastballs and can have enough power to get away with basically being a mistake hitter who will draw some walks. Like, that's just a very tough profile when you add in the lack of defensive value he has. It's probably always going to be a guy that I'm later to come around on, just given all of those question marks I have. But to hear you talk about him maybe being an under-the-radar guy or an interesting bat, that has me kind of curious. I don't know. I just have such questions about the actual hit tool with this one that I would be a little concerned.
Oh, no, the questions are very, very real, and I think they're legitimate. I don't see him having an issue actually hitting, like, you know, fastballs, changeups. I think he hits those. It's really the breaking stuff that gives him an issue, and the swing plane that leaves him vulnerable to, you know, like those kind of guys. All right, I expect him to go out and have success and low A and then probably high A, and then from there you're gonna get tested against, if he passes that test, then, you know, double A, triple A, and especially big league pitchers, it's gonna be a much more challenging at bat for him. But in double A, I mean, the strikeouts were still really high, and he's a right-handed hitting first baseman, all that, but like, he still did hit for power. He does draw walks. Like, if he didn't draw walks, then yes, I'd be a lot more concerned and be like, well, this profile is not quite as appealing. But
I think it's probably worth, like, I'm being a little bit dismissive here, but if you get even an up down guy or a bench bat, that's a massive win for a 10th round pick. So, like I said earlier, him already exceeding my expectations, I think, is still a good sign for just the Brewers in general with this pick, and there's a chance he still is just better than I expect him to be. And I'm getting kind of granular here, but do you know if he has any trouble with velocity at the top of the zone, just with you talking about how steep the bat path is? Because I imagine the big league pitchers will be more able to exploit that if he does have that sort of hole.
I have to go back and check. I don't have it off the top of my head right now, but it's, I do remember, like, you know, because he, like, this time last year, he was not a Brewers top 30 prospect because of all of these risk factors that we were talking about, and thought, all right, well, you know, by the time maybe he gets a double A, could hit a wall, but now he's, you know, squarely in the middle.
Yeah. The 26 homers, 24 doubles at double A later with nearly a 400 OBP.
Yeah. With, you know, and the best, well, Jackson Chourio is in that system, but I mean, it's, you know, it's a legitimate debate. I mean, him versus Wes Clark versus Jackson Chourio, who has more raw power, like, all right, well, who has a better chance to get to it? Probably Jackson Chourio. Chourio is just a better player, and I mean, he's also like 3 or 4 years younger than Wes Clark too. He's obviously a special player, but I mean, Clark has legit power. I mean, it's, like I said, up up to 115 EVs, home runs. Like his home run chart is, you know, left field, center field, right field. It's not like he's, and he's doing it. It's not like he's late on pitches. He's just, he can hammer the ball to any part of the field and out of any part of the park too.
All right. Anyone else in spring training that you want to touch on?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about guys who can make an impact this year, but I don't know. Did you see Johnny Farmello hit? Well, maybe it wasn't the greatest pitch in the world, but it was a, you know, mid '90s fastball that he hit for a home run. Mariners. What was he, a comp round pick?
He was actually, I think, pick 29. So he might have been. He might have been. Yeah, he might have been the actual comp pick that they got for Julio Rodriguez. I'll pull it up really quickly, but he was like pick 29 or 30, I believe. One of the many picks they had right there in that range.
Yeah, one of their plethora.
Yeah, he was the PPI pick 29. Colt Emerson was their actual first round pick at 22, and then their supplemental round pick, they took Ty Pete at 30. So a bunch of weird nomenclature with the Mariners picks, but either way, they got a bunch of toolsy, athletic prep hitters.
Yeah, I mean, Colt Emerson's been phenomenal so far. He'll be has a chance to be a top 25 prospect in baseball pretty soon. But I think Johnny Farmello is another one who has I was always drawn to him because I just thought he was a good hitter and then didn't realize, wow, this guy's also a really good athlete too.
Mine was similar. I thought he was a good hitter and good athlete, and I didn't realize how much power he had, and he continues to show that. So I'm going to wind up being really light on his power evaluation, I believe, because he's hitting the ball further than I expected him to, a lot sooner than I expected him to.
Yeah, I think it's whatever. It's more just like fun to see these, you know, younger guys, whether it's, you know, like a him or like, you know, Colt Emerson or whoever in big league camp, just to get a glimpse at them. But there's not too much to take away from these looks necessarily, but like he's somebody where you know, if you're looking for somebody who could be a future top 100 prospect out of that 2023 draft, he's somebody who I could see taking that jump this year.
Yeah, it'll be really fun to look back at this 2023 class in like 5 years. I mean, the expectations on it are very high. There have already been some players who look really good in pro ball. Obviously, no one fully established. We're not even a full year out from that draft, so it's kind of crazy to think about players like on the cusp, as close as they are, like Langford, Cruz, Skeens, Chanuel. But yeah, this is it is a very fun draft class. The preps, like Colt Emerson, like Bryce Eldridge, who very quickly raised, I think, their profiles just with the power they showed in pro ball as amateurs coming right in at the age they did. Guys like Matt Shaw, Tommy Troy showing some of the hitting chops. Like, it's just a phenomenal draft class with a lot of athletic, toolsy, up-the-middle players.
Walker Jenkins hasn't hurt himself.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about Walker Jenkins and Max Clark, who, in terms of tools, athleticism, stack up right there with the best of them. So we'll see what happens with it, but it'll be a really fun one to revisit.
Yeah. You got some good looks at the 2024 draft class this weekend, though, it sounds like.
I did. I basically got like 20% of the first round maybe this past weekend, which seems crazy when you're watching two programs also, Wake Forest and Duke, that like 10 years ago, you wouldn't have even thought of them as like the premier baseball programs in the state. But right now, Wake feels like one of the premier baseball programs in the entire country. Duke has done a really good job. In between Jonathan Santucci, Duke's Friday night starter, and Nick Kurtz, Sierra King, Chase Burns, Josh Hartle, Michael Massey, like there's six guys who maybe, I think Massey less so now than entering the year, but certainly all of those players are day one, and I think the first five pretty safe locks to be in the first round. We've got a lot of time to go, but certainly most of those players have kind of entered the year in a position where it'd be hard for them to fall out. And I don't think any of the first five have really done significantly to pull them entirely out of the first round. Burns has been phenomenal. Seaver King had a really loud weekend after slow starts this season for both Seaver King and Nick Kurtz. I think the entire Wake team is actually still kind of trying to figure things out. They're like defensively in particular, they looked pretty rough. But yeah, in terms of talent, in one series for the current year draft class, this has to be near the top or the top for me that I've seen. And there was a huge scouting crowd in.
How many scouts were there?
I had heard that each team had two scouts from the Wake communications department. I think there are like 40 plus more conservatively.
They limited them to...
They didn't limit them, but they had said like there are at least two from each team here, yeah, just because kind of like as a ballparking figure. But yeah, a lot of heavy hitters were there from teams picking at the top. The fun thing about this series, though, is like really every team, no matter where you're picking, can get a lot of value from scouting this series because there are players who are going to go top 10. There are guys that right now feel like they're fitting squarely in the middle. Guys like Michael Massey, maybe even some of the pitchers feel like they could go like 20-30. In the draft, so really every team should be in on that series and locked in, and it looked like there were like every team represented there. I mean, we can go through each player one by one, but I'd say Chase Burns and Seaver King were the most impressive in terms of on-field performance, even though I came away still pretty impressed with Nick Kurtz, despite the fact that his like numbers on the surface aren't outstanding right now.
Yeah, are you joining me on the Chase Burns hype wagon now, or what was your takeaways from watching him?
Wow, was my takeaway from watching him. I mean, it's explosive stuff. We knew that kind of going in, but it just is different when you're sitting behind the plate and actually watching it live and hearing him on the mound and seeing some of the ugly swings. It's just louder. There's more of an exclamation point when you're there watching it in person. And well,
he seems very loud and animated too.
He is loud. You know, what's interesting is I think he picks his spots on when to really go all out celebrating. And I think he kind of knew after his final strikeout in the sixth inning that he was done. And so he really aired it out. And there's good. You can go on and look at Wake Forest's Twitter account and see how animated and like loud he was shouting to his teammates, getting himself hyped up after his 14th strikeout of the game. But
yeah, I was like I said, I was sick and shivering and sweating in bed all weekend. So I just kind of like saw some highlights afterwards and I'm like scrolling through Twitter. I'm like, I was like seeing this guy jumping around the mound like a complete lunatic. I was like, did something happen earlier in this game? Because the scoreboard says 6-1.
No, he's just a ultra competitor, very high energy on the mound. Like he is very animated when he's striking people out. And I don't think it's like, in general, I am for that sort of action on the mound. Like that's not something that pisses me off, but he does direct it towards his teammates. So I think he does it in the most like acceptable way that even like old school scouts who might not like that or old school fans who think you're showing up other teams, like it'd be really hard for you to have a problem with that in my mind. In my mind, it would be hard for you to have a problem with that. Maybe not others. But, 14 punchies, 2 walks, 6 innings. The one home run he did allow was kind of like a Wake Forest ballpark homer where a hitter got under one of his pitches and it just kind of got carried out. I think in another park it would have been a well hit but fairly routine fly out. So, yeah, pretty lights out. I think you could 70 both the fastball and the slider. I think if you wanted, you could put 50s on the changeup and the curveball. And maybe the most impressive aspect of this whole outing to me was just how around the zone he was with the fastball and in general. I know we've talked about Chase Burns and the reliever risk and some of the delivery risk, and the delivery still looks the same to me. Like it is still a effortful, violent delivery, but I've been asking as many people as I could, like scouts who've been around the game for a long time, like what do you think about this delivery, what does it bode for him in the future? And like I think it might just be the case where he's one of the outlier athletes to where he can make that sort of high effort delivery work for him. And the stuff is just so explosive. Like I think he's solidly in like top 5 consideration at this stage, just given what some of the other players at the top of the board have done or have not done. And I think it's basically like him and Hagen Smith, like are the top 2 pure pitchers in the class. And I've gone out of my way to ask people like, who would you prefer? You get different answers and you get a lot of scouts who really have a hard time finding out who they actually prefer of those two. But yeah, Chase Burns has done nothing but improve his draft stock so far. The fastball velocity is up 3 ticks compared to his 2023 average. We'll see how the velo kind of holds up throughout the season. But I mean, seeing him use the curveball a little bit more, I think there is a solid enough changeup when you got a fastball and slider like that. I don't anticipate him ever running a like 10 or 15 plus percent changeup usage rate. But no, it was a pretty good look all around for him.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like a sitting upper 90s, explosive fastball, a lot of life to it, and then a wipeout slider. Like you said, I don't know that, well, maybe Hagen Smith has a case, but like a better fastball slider combination in the draft, especially from the,
yeah,
the right side than him.
The three I would put in the kind of tier of their own in terms of pure stuff would be Chase Burns, Hagen Smith, and then the left-handed factor certainly maybe puts Hagen in more freakish territory, but Burns and Brody Brecht, really. And I think Chase Burns, the quality of his fastball shape is probably a bit better, and certainly his ability to manipulate, land, and just utilize the slider is ahead at this stage than Brody Brecht. But in terms of pure arm talent, I think it's those three.
Yeah, and I think the strikes are a huge, obviously, separator between the absolutely. Two of those guys.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, so they were good. Siver King is just like, if you want to dream on a player, Siver King is such a great athlete with super twitchy hands. Like, his ability to put the barrel on the ball outside of the zone was like shockingly good, and I think that can hurt him at times. He's ultra aggressive in his approach. He likes to swing the bat, but also there were back-to-back walks. Jonathan Santucci on Friday night was struggling with control. Siver King saw two of his teammates get walked right in front of him, and I was kind of laughing like, oh, he's gonna swing at the first pitch, and he did. It was a slider, first pitch of his at bat, he swung at it and he homered. And there are a couple instances where he had really loud, impactful batted balls on the first pitch. And then there are other instances where he's just swinging at bad pitches early in the count and getting himself out. So I'll be curious to see how the approach develops for him throughout the season as he sees more like ACC quality pitching. He didn't seem fazed by velocity. I think he is a little bit more pull happy at times. So maybe he's just going to be this more streaky hitter. But we also got to see him at shortstop, which I was not expecting. Wake's starting shortstop, Merrick Houston, who's a solid defender, was pulled halfway through the series with like a hammy tweak. And so Siver King came in from shortstop to center field and made a few really impressive plays. He's a double plus runner. He had multiple 70 grade times out of the box, so the range is not an issue there. He's got enough arm strength for the position. I think the actions are good. The hands, I'm not fully sold on. Like, there are a few backhanded attempts where I thought he could have been a little bit better, but again, this is getting pretty nitpicky. But in terms of like tool set and athlete and like impactful player, Siver King is really exciting.
Yeah, what did you, I was going to ask you about the approach, because as we're now seeing him face, you know, better pitching, it does seem like he is a very aggressive hitter, almost I would say to a fault.
Yeah,
in his case, where okay, yeah, like you said, he's the kind of guy where he can make contact even outside the strike zone. But yeah, that works now in college. And as you move up, it's going to become a problem. He's swinging at more than 50% of the pitches he's seeing. So he's chasing quite a bit outside the strike zone to you. Is that a red flag, or how big of a concern is that for you with him?
It's a concern. I mean, I think physically he has the tools to be an above average hitter. And I think the approach is really what's holding him back. Because like you said, like his bat to ball skills are so good that he can get to a lot. And because of that, I think he just puts himself into bad positions at times where he's swinging at pitches that he can put the barrel on, but are not necessarily the pitches he should be swinging at early in the count. In those situations, I would like to see him be a little bit more selective early on. I think he also just can be a little pull happy. Like, his lower half is definitely leaking to the pull side at times. There were times where I also wondered about his breaking ball recognition. The home run he had was against a breaking ball, so he certainly can damage a breaking ball, but his takes and swings against quality breaking stuff was significantly different than Nick Kurtz in my mind, who, like, they're batting back-to-back in the lineup, so it's kind of fun to see them hitting next to each other because they're such different hitters with different approaches, and you can, like, that contrast, I think, makes what they do well and what they do poorly stand out even more. So I would be curious, like, how he handles some of the better breaking stuff he's going to see this season. He has more than enough bat speed to handle velocity. I don't really have questions about him handling fastballs. It's just that approach, like, is he going to be a guy who can develop a better approach, Or is he always going to be maybe more of this streaky hitter who kind of lives and dies with the balls in play, whether or not they're landing? I think a guy like Nick Kurtz, he's going to give you a really solid floor of on-base value because he will take pitches. He'll take walks. He's more than happy to take a walk. All of his swing decisions are strong, and that's not the case with Seaver King. But Seaver King, again, is a 70-grade runner who is going to play up the middle somewhere, and he looked pretty good at shortstop. So they're just such vastly different profiles, and I think you could probably get really different opinions on who you prefer depending on the team philosophy, your personal scouting philosophy, like how much the first base profile in college scares you. But there's certainly a lot to like and some things that Seaver King still needs to improve upon moving forward. But it was a really fun look. And I also appreciate Seaver King because he consistently had high effort run times out of the box, and he gets out of the box exceptionally quickly. So
how would you compare Seaver King as a hitter compared to Brayden Montgomery from outfield, well, two-way player from Texas A&M, who also could be a top 10 overall pick this year?
Yeah, Brayden seems a lot more willing to take a walk than mm-hmm. Seaver King does. I haven't seen him in person recently, but he feels like much more of like a power and patience profile than Seaver King, who's a lot more like bat-to-ball driven with his profile. They don't seem particularly similar to me, but do you like one or the other? Or I was interested to see what player you were going to bring up, and I was not expecting Montgomery at all.
No, well, just as far as two players who, you know, at least at this point in the process, are in a similar spot as far as where they could go.
Yeah, I think in terms of like scout feedback I've gotten so far, it feels like people are more excited about Montgomery's upside in the draft. Like he seems to be pushing like top five range. I haven't heard that quite yet with Seaver King. Maybe that changed this past weekend. I think he was pretty much the same player that he was expected to be entering it. Like I don't know that too much changed other than he like actually had some good performance against the best team he's faced. But people really do like Montgomery, like the power that he can provide. And again, I think his ability to draw some walks is going to help him out as well.
Yeah. Whereas like Vance Honeycutt, another outfielder who's probably, you know, obviously we're going to update our rankings, but, you know, somebody else at least coming into the season very high up the board, outfielder at North Carolina, who seems like he has his own very different set of strong strengths and strong red flags as well.
Yeah, I actually think if you wanted to compare and contrast Vance Honeycutt and Seaver King, that would make a lot of sense because they're both really impressive athletes, potential up-the-middle players. I mean, I think Vance Honeycutt is a much better center field defender right now. I think Seaver King could become a good one, but they both have speed. I think Vance Honeycutt has a little more power, but both these two have real hit tool questions, like how good are they going to be at the next level? But certainly, yeah, we've got a draft shuffling coming up very soon. So I've been looking at and thinking through a lot of these players and trying to figure out where they need to land. But it has been fun just how wide open this draft class is because there's so much shuffling up top, whereas a year ago it felt like we kind of put Paul Skeens up into this grouping, and then otherwise it was the same. Dylan Cruz, Max Clarks, and Walker Jenkins of the world.
All right. How about, yeah, I mean, you got to see Nick Kurtz too. Probably not the, I mean, he's hitting 220, 466, 380 through his first 15 games. Probably not the start we were expecting for Nick Kurtz.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, it's just simply as a first base profile where he's at, he just has to hit and has to perform to go where we currently have him on the board, number two. I think he's slipping out of that range right now based on his slow start and just based on some other players in the country, Travis Bezzano, Condon at Georgia, just going off, guys like Chase Burns, Hagen Smith really pitching really well. So there's just not a large margin for error for Nick Kurtz in terms of his performance. He needs to get his numbers back up to sophomore and freshman year numbers, but he is now the focal point in Wake's lineup after Brock Wilkins' departure. I think you're seeing that early this year and how teams are pitching him. He's getting fewer strikes in the zone. And like I said earlier, he is a hitter who is perfectly capable of just watching those pitches go by and trotting down to first base. You mentioned his numbers, like the balls haven't been falling for him, but he's still getting on base at nearly a 50% clip. I think that is like something that is part of his profile that you're always going to be able to have. But the baseline and the threshold for offensive production for a first base only type, you just need to, you need to feel good about what he's done recently to draft him that high. And he hasn't turned it on yet. I actually was more impressed with him coming out of this weekend than you maybe would expect given the numbers. I thought pretty much every plate appearance, he looked good. He takes quality swing decisions. He hit some balls hard, foul. He hit one ball, one of the harder hit balls, I thought. I don't have the actual numbers, like exit velocities, to confirm that, but to deep, like center field, that he just missed. He pulled one ball foul out of the park. I thought he stood in against Jonathan Santucci and saw the left-left slider, which is, I think, a plus pitch at his best, even though it wasn't quite as good as it normally was this weekend. He looked great against him, I thought. So really, I think he has all the traits that make an above average or a plus hitter. It's just a matter of like getting those results as the season progresses.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, is because maybe the numbers overall are not great, but he still has 22 walks to 12 strikeouts. He only has two home runs, but I don't know that there's anybody in the world who doubts that Nick Kurtz has huge power. I mean, we saw it last year. We see it in the exit velocity numbers too. Is this just right now a matter of like the results not matching with the underlying process, sort of like what we saw with the Red Sox with the Roman Anthony in the first couple months of the season last year, where like maybe like the numbers on paper were not great, but like he was still making good swing decisions, hitting the ball hard, like everything looked right. He just was having some bad luck, and then it turned around for him and he went off after that, or are there more cause for concern, especially as a first base prospect where like you really do have to mash.
I would say definitely more of the former for me, based on my look this weekend. Like I said, his BPs are really professional. At-bats in the game I thought were really good. Like, there's nothing he's doing at the plate that's leading me to have any concerns about him not being the hitter that I expected him to be. The last point you made, though, about him just being a first baseman, I think is tricky, because there are going to be a lot of teams that they just, you're going to have to look down and see the numbers to draft him that high. I don't think that there's any chance he falls like outside of the first round, obviously, but he's getting closer towards like pick 10 than you might have expected entering the year. I thought that a lot of his batted balls were solid and kind of just hit right at people a few times. He certainly had some where he popped out and got under a little bit. So maybe he hasn't like fully capitalized on some swings that a year ago he would have. But like, I have very few question marks about his hitting ability, his approach, his power, like you said, now compared to a year ago. I actually didn't think he looked as good defensively at first base as like he's reputed to be. There are a few like short hopped throws that I thought like a plus defensive first baseman probably should have made. But I don't think that is really what you're worried too much about with Nick Kurtz outside of like the offensive performance. So I would say that I'm pretty optimistic for what he's going to do moving forward the rest of the year. And I would imagine too, as we're getting into ACC competition, there will be more pitchers who are willing to challenge him and throw him pitches in the zone. Like, he's getting like 6% fewer strikes in the zone compared to his first two seasons right now. Hopefully that changes, but again, I think he is the sort of hitter who, he's not going to press too much. He's not going to expand the zone. If he's not getting a lot to hit, he'll just happily walk. And that leads to less opportunities to put a ball in play. I think right now his walk rate is near 30% and one of the highest in the entire country. So hopefully he just gets more stuff in the zone to swing at moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really low swinging strike rate too. And the power is definitely there. I think, I don't know, maybe, you know, if we look up in 2 months and obviously the numbers are still here, then yeah, that's going to be an issue, but he's somebody where I expect him to turn it around in a big way pretty soon.
Yeah, I agree. I'd be more bullish. And I think his falling down the board is as much because guys like Condon, Burns, Hagen Smith are moving up. And those are profiles that maybe have a little more leeway than a college first base profile as anything that Nick Kurtz is like doing under the hood.
Yeah. Charlie Condon. I know Georgia hasn't played like a great schedule to start the year, I think, is that fair to say? But yeah, what he's done has been pretty impressive.
Yeah, and with SEC play kicking up, he'll be even more fun to watch moving forward. So, yeah, he's been phenomenal.
Yeah, well, yeah, but they really haven't. I don't know. People are really, really buying in on him as a potential 1-1 guy, or is there any concern about the quality of play that he has or maybe has?
I mean, certainly if he falls off a cliff in SEC play, he won't be in 1-1 consideration. But right now, today, I think he absolutely is. I think his pure hitting ability, his raw power, I mean, similar to Nick Kurtz, they have pretty similar offensive profiles in terms of their contact and power. You can maybe say a little more power for Condon, a little more advanced approach from Kurtz, but that's also entering the year. I think Condon has shown a mature approach, a better pure hit tool than I was expecting. I know it's been better than some scouts who I've talked to have been expecting. And I think the biggest difference, if you're just comparing Condon and Kurtz, is the fact that Condon is playing a number of positions that are not first base. And he looks like he actually might be able to play one of those positions reasonably well. And so just the way that changes the profile is significant. And he's currently among the leaders or leading the country with 12 home runs already. So like, regardless of whether or not the competition has been top tier, like Nick Kurtz also entered this weekend not having faced a super challenging schedule and hasn't done the same thing. So at the end of the day, like performing against whoever you're facing still matters. So yeah, I think he's squarely in that mix right now.
All right. Are we talking like a Chris Bryant level, like 6'6", right-handed? I mean, Chris Bryant hit, I think he led Division I baseball in home runs by like 10 over the next guy. So he was doing it in like a different era of college baseball and college baseball equipment, to say the least. I mean, is he potentially that type of guy, or is that too rich?
I haven't thought about that one.
Or we'll see once SEC play gets
going. Yeah, let's see SEC play get going. Let's see. It definitely feels hard to compare just given the home run rates of college baseball in recent years. And it also feels weird to think about a Chris Bryant talent in this year's draft class. But Condon has certainly elevated his stock so far. I mean, he's demolishing the baseball. He's hitting .565, .659, .1274 slug. More walks than strikeouts. Again, yeah, it'll be good to see SEC.
More home runs than strikeouts.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. Have to imagine that will not hold up as he gets into SEC and faces some of these Friday night arms, but I guess we'll see. I'll hold off on the Chris Bryant comp or lack thereof for now and hope to see him a little bit more and get a better feel. But in terms of like stacking up in this year's class, I mean, you could take him 1-1 today, and I don't think anyone would be surprised.
All right. Who else? Anybody struggle, or how are some of the other arms in that series you saw?
Yeah, I think all the other arms that I saw, who I was looking to see, Jonathan Santucci, Josh Hartle, Michael Massey, were all, I'd say, disappointing based on expectations. I think with Hartle and Santucci specifically, you give them something of a pass. The Friday night conditions were not ideal. The game was delayed. It was rainy, just kind of crappy day overall. This is also their first biggest challenge of the year, the best lineups they've faced like fairly easily. But Santucci's slider just wasn't quite as sharp and consistent as it previously was. I thought early on his fastball command was okay, and then that sort of backed up, and that's kind of his biggest question mark right now, is how good is the fastball command. But he got hit around a bit, I think, in part because the Wake lineup was, it looked like they were sitting on the slider, which makes sense because Santucci entered this throwing the slider more than half the time. And I would like to see that decrease moving forward because his fastball is really good. It has plus traits. Josh Hartle, I think I've just cursed Josh Hartle. I never seem to see him pitch well when I'm in the stands actually watching him. He got hit around 11 hits in 3-plus innings. Yeah, and Hartle, like, none of his pitches look above average or plus at this stage. He is definitely the pitchability lefty who mixes and matches, nibbles around the zone. But, I mean, he's throwing a cutter that's in the upper 80s, mostly as his, like, in-zone strike pitch. The breaking ball is kind of a little loopier, slurvy type thing. I think he calls it a slider, but if you wanted to call it a curve, that would make sense too. There's just not a lot of impact wow stuff with Hartle, and so he's really reliant on throwing strikes, getting weak ground ball contact, and he got a lot of that against Duke last week, but his defenders didn't really help him out. So he's just going to be one of those players, I think, that is more reliant on like the defense behind him than a player like Burns and Hagan Smith, who can just rack up strikeouts. So that's going to be a polarizing profile, I think, for a lot of teams. And then Michael Massey, he pitched only two innings on Sunday, really struggled with his command. The fastball and slider are a tick slower than they were out of a bullpen role. He is transitioning from bullpen to starter role, so maybe that is kind of expected. Maybe it'll get back towards what it was in the pen as he gets stretched out. But certainly his worst start of the year on Sunday for me too. So I think both Santucci and Hartle do enough that probably still somewhere in the first round they have a spot, and I'm not going to write them off because of one bad start. Like, I think both these guys will bounce back and be okay. But there are certainly more warts you can find with these guys than guys like Hagan Smith and Chase Burns right now.
Yeah, the Hartle profile is the one that scares me probably the most. Feels like, I don't know, maybe a back-end starter, maybe.
Like, I mean, like, I don't view his profile right now as any more impactful than, like, what Jared Schuster is at this stage at Awake a few years prior. And, like, I think for some teams that just aren't able to or are unwilling to go get starters on the open market, there is a value in a player that you know is a high probability big league starter. But I think there are going to be a lot of teams who are like, we don't want to take a number five starter in the first round. We want to get more impact. And if that's how you think, I don't think Josh Hartle is the player for you.
Yeah, I think the guy actually I'd give a little bit more slack to would be Michael Massey, just in terms of him. And look, he's transitioning from a bullpen to a starter role. So maybe give him a little bit more time to build up, but yeah. Also
and,
at the same
he is
time,
still let's... being stretched out. Like he's slowly upped the pitch count. It was like 50 pitches, then 60, then 78 last time out. He didn't throw a lot of pitches this last outing just because he wasn't performing, but I'm with you there. Like I'll give him a little more time.
Yeah, but at the other hand, okay, like we need to see it in a starting role. Assuming you want to draft him as a starter, which maybe you don't, or you just want to put him back into the bullpen because he does seem like he has a potentially, maybe not elite velocity, but elite fastball characteristics. Yeah. Just the ability to have that riding fastball hopping over barrels and then missing a lot of bats with his breaking stuff as well, where like maybe he doesn't light up the radar gun. But the swing and miss numbers on that pitch and the breaking stuff too is really high.
Yeah, so he's worked in a new breaking ball this year. He's throwing like a slower mid-70s curve in addition to his slider. So that's kind of been his arsenal tweak as he's moved into a starting role. I guess he might be throwing a few more changeups as well, but it wasn't really much of a factor when I saw him. But yeah, seeing how he looks in the middle of the season, I think will go a long way in showing team. And maybe there'll be a team who drafts him thinking he's a reliever, but giving him a chance to start initially and just seeing how it goes. But he certainly has feel for spin and pitch traits with the fastball and with the delivery that I think a lot of teams will be excited about. I mean, you can make a case that just in terms of pitch shape, Michael Massey has like the perfect sort of fastball that you want to take in this day and age. So it's two ticks slower, but I think even if it's like below average velocity, it'll be effective. It's just a year ago in a bullpen role, he was throwing it with above average velocity.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's kind of all I have for you, Ben, unless you want to talk about AJ Gracia, but he's a freshman and we've got a few years for him.
I do like AJ Gracia. Yeah, no, it's Duke has a good lineup this year. No, it was a good test for those Wake Forest arms. I do like AJ Gracia. High school or freshman out of high school from New Jersey last year. I went back and read the report. I was like, what did I write about this guy? And
I read that recently as well because I was curious. You had him in. And
it was like, nobody's going to scout this guy because
he's getting to Duke.
Yeah, because A, everybody thinks he's getting to Duke. B, he wasn't like a big – for whatever reason, I don't understand why. He was – I mean, we had him ranked as an underclassman in our top 100 high school players in that class. I was like, oh, I like the left-handed hitting ability, the power, strong arm too, obviously. It was doing the two-way thing in high school. I don't know if he's going to keep doing it now. Maybe he's just too good of a hitter.
Yeah, screw that. Let him hit. He's so good as a hitter.
Exactly. So I was like, yeah, so I wrote,
right
I was
field.
Like, this guy is not really getting a whole lot of scouting attention this year, but like, I think he's going to go to Duke right away and be an impact guy. And, now I feel really
like
good about that.
Yeah, it looks like you were right on that one, Ben.
Yeah, did not have multiple multi-homer games as of March 12th.
But. Oh, and one of the second homer he hit was like a titanic blast to right field. I don't know if you saw it, but it was like 89 in on the hands. He got the barrel out super quick, turned on this ball, and it was like a monstrous home run. I was trying to find like TrackMan estimated like distance and EVs. I couldn't find it, but it had to have been well over 400 feet. It was an absolute moonshot. And he looked good. The first night, he put the barrel in the ball seemingly every AB. He had two home runs. I think he added a double in that game as well. Like he looks like he's going to be a dude. I mean, he is a dude now for Duke, so he'll be fun to watch in a few more years, adding more strength to that tall, big frame. It's kind of an odd-looking swing at times, but he's made it work, and he's hit for a lot more contact than I would have expected for someone with that swing. And like the swing decisions were really good too. He looked like he knew what he was doing up there. And it's a lot of left-handed impact. So, yeah, remember the name AJ Gracia. I'm sure you'll be hearing about him more over the next few years.
Yeah, some pretty fun freshmen this year and
a lot
college baseball. I think we're going to hear some, obviously, Drew Burris and Daniel Cuvée and Trent Carraway. And
Daniel Cuvée has been a shockingly good hitter for his reputation coming out of high school. The power was not a surprise, but
man. Monster power. Him and Burris, monster. Yeah. Power in two very different sized human beings. Daniel Cuvée is 6'4", big, strong, looks like what you think a power hitter will look like. And Drew Burris is strong too, but he's not 6'4". He's maybe 5'8".
One other thing I wanted to ask you from this Wake series has nothing to do with players. I'm curious what you think about this strategy, but Wake seemed to have this routine where during BP they're playing like typical BP music for their hitters, like kind of hype hip-hop modern music, mm-hmm. and then when Duke comes to hit, they're basically playing like love ballads. The tone shifts dramatically. It's not as bad as some parks I've seen where they're playing like joke music, but it definitely is like a vibe shift. I thought it was funny at first, and then it quickly started getting on my nerves. What is your take on that?
I'm not a big fan of that. I mean,
yeah, it definitely seems like a common college thing recently. I noticed it last year as well. I think at LSU it happened.
Yeah, I just kind of play it straight. I mean, yeah. Other teams are going to do that to you when you go on the road now.
It happened and I kind of laughed at first and then it kept going and I was like, this is honestly really petty and like probably really annoying. But
like it seems a little childish, honestly.
Exactly. That's kind of what I thought at the end of it. I'm not a huge fan of it, but it's meaning. I mean, Duke won the series, so they're probably fine.
Yeah. No, they're doing all right now.
They're doing fairly good. Yeah.
Like they're what, number three in the country?
Yeah, they moved up to number three, taken off then number one ranked Wake Forest. I guess I'll give you a pretty solid jump.
Yeah. No, it's a pretty, like you said earlier. It's a pretty huge turnaround from where that program was 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, and they're really doing it. Like, I don't know that a lot of the players in their lineup are super prospecty. There are a lot of like older players, transfers in who are just like good college players, good college hitters. But certainly they've been really well-rounded. They're hitting, they're pitching. So yeah, a solid team.
And AJ Gracia is definitely a prospect.
He's definitely a prospect, yeah.
Macon Winslow too, another good freshman catcher. And I think he's playing a little around the field too, but another pretty promising freshman for them. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That's all I've got, Ben. Anything else you want to hit on before we get out of here?
No, it was a good episode, Carlos. Great job by us.
Yeah. What grade are you putting on this one, Ben? Going to go with the famous 65 grade, break out the half grades.
Well, it was a 60. I'm still not 100% right now, so I'm getting my reps back after missing.
Gotcha. Still getting your game timing back. So, yeah. All right. Well, hopefully you're able to rest up, feel a little bit better. Hopefully your trip goes well. Not sure exactly when our next episode will be. We're obviously trying to keep them as consistent as we can once travel gets going, but travel and health obviously makes that trickier. So, other than that, thank you guys for listening. Thanks for hanging out with us. Thanks for supporting BA in general. I know we've got a lot of people running around to do travel domestically. Jeff, Josh, JJ, Savannah, I think are all going to do spring training. So there'll be a lot of content from them. And on the amateur side, it'll be the same old draft notebooks, regularly, draft updates regularly, College Top 25 updated weekly. Just plenty of stuff happening. As Major Leagues gets going, we'll be in full swing, and it really already feels like we're in full spring swing this spring. So, for Ben, I'm Carlos. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.